welcome to the Science Podcast for November 9th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, climate and ancient Mayan politics, the challenges of weather forecasting, and an unusual coral symbiosis.
We know of no other example anywhere in nature where something that is threatened by a competitor chemically calls in a bodyguard to take care of that competitor.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Coral reefs are diverse, dynamic ecosystems, reliant not only on water temperature and chemistry, but also on a give and take with neighboring flora and fauna. In a report this week, Mark Hay and co-author Daniel Dixon reveal a surprising marine symbiosis in which corals chemically cue protection from nearby fishes. Hay spoke with me from his office in Atlanta.
Corals are declining worldwide while seaweeds are increasing, and we've been studying sort of how seaweeds damage corals, often showing that it's seaweed-produced compounds that are damaging corals on contact. And we know that from large studies that herbivorous fishes are really important at a reef scale. When those are overfished, it advantages seaweeds and disadvantages corals. But we started thinking about this on a small scale and saying, well, it's really where the seaweeds and the corals come into contact, and do corals have any way of mediating that interaction? And one of the things we thought about is, well, recruit bodyguards to take care of you. And so we wanted to look at some of the fishes that we knew were associated with these corals and whether they might be doing something to protect their home coral.
And for this study, you decided to focus in on one particular species of coral, a very common species called Acropora nasuta. Why did you decide to focus on this one?
Well, one, it's really common on the reef we were working on. Two, because it was common and it's typical of a genus that's particularly important worldwide in that it's a branching coral and it creates a lot of the structure on coral reefs. It's not the only thing that does that, but it's one of the main what we call making topographic complexity, and that complexity gives lots of other organisms on the reef a structure in which to live. And so we thought it was sort of a key species that produced something that many other organisms on the reef needed.
And so you had this notion that there might be these herbivorous bodyguards out there for corals. How did you delve into this interesting relationship a little bit more closely?
Okay, well, we looked at a number of species of fishes. There were four that we saw that were commonly associated with this coral, two species of gobies and two species of damsel fishes. And the damsels hang out around the coral and dart back into it when threatened. The gobies actually live down in the coral framework almost all the time. And we'd also studied a bunch of different seaweeds. So we took the most toxic seaweed that was the most damaging to these corals, and we moved it against the coral and said, what did the fish do? And when we did that, the damsel fishes that move among coral heads but are often associated with one just said, okay, our home site's in trouble. We're leaving. And within 24 to 48 hours, they all abandoned that coral and went to another one. The gobies, on the other hand, went out and started trimming this toxic alga. And there were two species of gobies. They both went out and trimmed it back. So they're like little barbers that run out and just eat enough of it or bite enough of it off so that it doesn't touch the coral anymore. And this seaweed actually has an oily substance on the surface of the seaweed that has to rub off on the coral to transfer this toxin. And when those gobies did this, one of them actually ate the alga. That goby makes a mucilage when it's attacked that is toxic to predators, and that mucilage became more toxic. The other goby didn't eat it. It would bite it off, but it didn't consume it, and it's not toxic. So one of them was actually using a toxin in its own defense, and the other one was simply protecting the home site.
Now, is this toxic seaweed a normal part of the goby fish's diet?
No. Probably not. In other words, it's a fairly rare seaweed on the reef. It's maybe on our reefs 1 or 2% of the cover on the reef at most. And so many times you would find these gobies on corals that would not be anywhere near this particular seaweed. And so we looked at the gut contents of gobies from around the reef, and we almost never found this seaweed unless we had put it against the coral. And that's when they came out and ate it.
So what exactly is signaling these fish to eat this seaweed?
Okay, so here's the really cool part of this whole thing. It's sort of a chemically mediated or nuanced dance that goes on. The seaweed recruits and uses chemistry to start to kill the coral off. The coral then makes a compound. We don't know what that compound is, but we know the coral's doing it, that signals the goby to come over and whack this seaweed back. And we can tell that by, we can suck water from the seaweed and squirt it into the coral head, and the goby doesn't care. We can suck it from where the seaweed and the coral are touching each other, and then the goby runs over to that site. We can let them touch each other for a little while and then remove the seaweed for 20 minutes, and we can show with dye studies that all the water that was there is gone within a couple of minutes, and then suck water from that site where the coral and the seaweed were touching and squirt that in, and then the gobies run over toward it. And so the coral itself is producing something that's calling in the bodyguard.
Wow. So you've really uncovered a very unusual symbiotic relationship here, that through chemical signaling from the coral, the gobies then protect the coral. But by doing this, the gobies are simultaneously sort of armoring themselves against their own predators.
One of them is, and the other isn't. So it's not just that. Both of them are protecting their home site. This is a place where they live their whole lives, by and large, in a single coral head. That coral head provides them with some food. They eat part of the coral mucilage, and so it's a feeding site as well as a home site. So both species are protecting the home site. One of them is also becoming more toxic to predators when it does that.
Wow. Well, do we know of any other pairs of species that behave in this same sort of way?
We know a little bit about some. We know of no other example anywhere in nature where something that is threatened by a competitor chemically calls in a bodyguard to take care of that competitor. But we do know of other things that look like this. There are terrestrial plants that make special little places on themselves, these sort of hollow thorns where ants live in those, and they make special little food bodies that they feed to the ants. And those ants then patrol the plant, and if insects that would eat the plant land on there, the ants run out, they grab them by the legs, they sort of rip the legs and wings off and pitch them off the plant. They will also patrol right under the plant and remove competitors that are in contact with the plant, just like our fish do. So, you know, 30 years ago, when I first went into the deserts, I started looking at plants and ants interactions, and seeing these fish, thought, you know, something like that could be going on. And actually, my postdoc, Danielle Dixon, was the one that really came up with this, because she knew more about the fish and the coral association. And we said, you know, a little crazy. We don't know about this for marine systems, but it could be. These could be underwater ant plants, and it looks like they are.
Oh, that's so cool. Now, you begin your paper by outlining the dire circumstances that a lot of corals are in right now around the world. Coral cover is declining, especially in many areas in the Caribbean Ocean and the Great Barrier Reef. And of course, that decline is happening for a number of reasons. But how do you see this particular study fitting into the greater field of coral reef research and conservation?
What we're trying to do in my lab is to sort of interpret how reefs work, and we're trying to understand the language that is used there. And if you think about it, most organisms on Earth don't have eyes, don't have ears, and so they either eat the thing next to them, run from it, or mate with it based on chemical signals. And so we're trying to understand those chemical signals in a way that allows us to understand more about how the whole system's working. And in this particular instance, what we wanted to do is to say, you know, what can corals do to fight back, and are there critical things we don't know about that may help the system run? And so at some level, you know, we're looking at communities in general or ecosystems in general and trying to understand the language that the instructions are written in so that we could intervene in wiser ways for both conservation management, but also just to fundamentally understand the ecology and evolution of those systems. When we find that these corals are producing a chemical that tells a particular fish to come over and do a particular thing to a particular alga, that means that over evolutionary time, competition with seaweeds or other similar organisms has been important enough to drive those kind of signalings and to drive those mutualistic relationships. Hmm. And so it gives us evolutionary insight to know what the mechanisms are and to say this has been important enough that this has evolved to work in this way.
Right. Great. Well, Mark Hay, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your guys' interest.
Mark Hay and Danielle Dixon write about chemical cues for coral bodyguards in a report this week.
As one cycle of the Mayan calendar approaches its end, we may be closer than ever to understanding why their civilization ultimately collapsed. Of the many theories for Mayan collapse, a several hundred-year drought in the region is a primary candidate for their decline. Douglas Kennett and colleagues examined this idea using isotopic oxygen and stalagmite deposits to calculate rainfall patterns during the Mayan civilization. I spoke with Kennett from his office at Penn State University.
So the Maya are a sophisticated and complex society that developed in the tropical rainforest of Guatemala, Belize, Mexico, and Honduras during the classic period, a period between AD 300 and 900. And there are a variety of different ideas about why the Maya collapsed. They range from environmental degradation related to their agricultural systems and overpopulation to political kinds of explanations where there was interpolity warfare between those centers, which ultimately led to disintegration. And then for a while, there had been the idea that climate and climate change may play a role, in particular drought in this region.
So in your paper, you were interested in isolating the climate conditions during the Mayan civilization. How did you determine these conditions, and how do they differ from what other researchers have tried?
Yes, we were particularly interested in developing a climate record for this region that was very well dated. So we were interested in developing a record for the last 2,000 years. And we did this using cave deposits, stalagmites, which grow in caves. If you're lucky, they grow continuously, and you can obtain a climate record from them by using oxygen isotopes, which basically reflect the amount of rainfall at any given time falling above the cave, and then that rainwater seeping into the cave system and forming the stalagmite. So basically they grow like, you can kind of think about tree rings, they grow incrementally like that, and they preserve a climate record. We were lucky to basically obtain stalagmites that grew continuously through this time period, through the last 2,000 years. And we basically were able to see sort of broad cycles of wet conditions and dry conditions. And then we were also able to see fairly abrupt and short-term drought in the record. So, and we were actually interested in climate change on both of those timescales. And what we determined was that the growth of Maya civilization and increases in population and levels of sophistication actually correlate with a very wet interval that, you know, spans several hundred years during what's called the early classic period. And the sort of decline of the Maya actually appear to correlate with a downturn generally in climate and climate drying, starting at around AD 660. And what we see is an increase in warfare at this time, which we argue in the paper is linked to troubles in their economic system related to decreased productivity of their agricultural systems.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't enough rain and they couldn't grow their crops, and that just led to strife within the civilization.
Exactly. That's our basic argument. And that led ultimately to a political decline. Actually, we see some of these cities collapsing as early as the late AD 600s, starting after about 660. And then we see a large number of them decline between AD 800 and 900. And there is a long-term drought that does occur in that interval. But we're actually looking at that compounding problems that were already occurring in the system related to this more general drought that was occurring after AD 660. That's what's generally known as the Maya collapse, or the collapse of those political systems. Cities like Tikal, Copan, Calakmul, these are Maya cities. Divine kings that were in charge of those basically lost control. And we see population decentralization. So people started moving away from those centers.
So does this research kind of put the nail in the coffin for why the Mayan civilization eventually collapsed?
Well, I think it's a major contribution to trying to understand the complex processes that went into the decline of the Maya. Now that we have this very well-constrained climate sequence, we can start thinking about some of the more complex social and political processes involved with that collapse, because it clearly played out over several hundred years, and climate plays one role in that decline, we argue. What's interesting is after the major period of political collapse, there's actually the biggest drought in the record actually occurs after that time between AD 1000 and 1100. And we're very interested in that because that may have major population effects within the region. We hypothesize this based on some new archaeological data that's coming out from several regions suggesting that although the political systems had collapsed earlier, people living in smaller agricultural communities persisted in the region. But after that time, we see very little in the way of population in multiple areas within the Maya region.
What do researchers think caused these climactic events?
Well, they're basically, you know, linked to broader periods of global climate change. The overall team, the climatologists involved in this interdisciplinary team, I should mention that this is a large group doing this work, they're actually looking at some of the interrelationships between this rainfall record and what we argue to be the primary mechanism for change, which is the position of the intertropical convergence zone, which basically is positioned mainly over the equator and then moves up and down kind of over parts of the northern part of South America. And depending on its position, either the Maya region receives more rainfall or less rainfall. This actually happens seasonally. There's a seasonal monsoon there. So you get a period of wet conditions during the year and a period of dry conditions. And that's actually related to the position of this intertropical convergence zone. But it also moves on longer time scales. So you can have intervals where there's very little rainfall occurring within the Maya region, or there may be more rainfall if it's in a different position. And that looks like it could be tied to things that are happening in the northern hemisphere temperature changes. At this point, we're looking at those kind of complex linkages to try to see how the climate system in the Maya region is actually linked to broader patterns of global climate change.
So do you think this methodology will actually lend itself to studying other cultures?
Yeah, there's no question about it. Anywhere where you have cave systems that have stalagmites, this kind of work can be done. There is an analogous study that's already been done in China, and I imagine that there are other studies that are also occurring in that large country. So there are some interesting historical records as well, because that's the other part of this story, is we also looked in detail at some of the historical records in the Maya region. You have to have a specific kind of karst environment, which is basically a rich limestone geological substrate. And if you have that, then you have the potential for having caves that have stalagmites in them. And if you have stalagmites, then there's a possibility of extracting these very detailed and well-dated climatic records.
So what are your future plans for working with the climate of the Mayan civilization?
Well, this is really the first phase of a large interdisciplinary project that's focused in on just kind of the complex relationship between societal responses, so the economic systems, social systems, and political systems to climate change, but also to environmental changes of different types. So humans also influence the environment through their agricultural systems, through deforestation and through that erosion to the landscape. So we're kind of looking at climate as one part of a very complex system. And this is one of the foundational data sets for looking at these complex interactions in much more detailed fashion using a modeling approach. So that's really the next stage, is developing some more sophisticated models for how climate influences societies. And that's the long-term goal of the project.
Well, Douglas Kennett, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much, Edward.
Douglas Kennett and colleagues measure historical rainfall patterns during the Mayan civilization using oxygen isotopes in this week's issue.
Since the 1990s, U.S. meteorologists have been able to push tornado warnings from an average of 3 minutes prior to the appearance of the dangerous funnel to an average of 10 minutes in advance. However, about 75% of these warnings are false alarms. Sarah Crespi spoke with science writer Richard Kerr about the sunny outlook for weather prediction and the few cloudy spots that remain.
There's been considerable increase in understanding the weather, what it is, and why it changes. But most of that advancement was the really breakthrough stuff was back in the earlier part of the last century The big drivers now are better observations. The National Weather Service has Doppler radars spread across this country. We've got increasingly capable satellites in orbit. But combined with that is the increasing available computer power. Weather forecasting these days is all about computer model forecasting. And the more computer power you have, the more you can do with the models.
And that's been on the rise, right? What's happened with computing power in the past decade or so?
Well, weather forecasters got into computer models in the 1950s. And since then, the computer power available to the National Weather Service has gone up by a factor of 100 billion.
Wow.
I mean, they've got 100 million megaflops to work with. Now, they're doing a lot of different kinds of weather forecasting. And to this day, it's the computer power that's limiting. Mm. Forecasters know a bit more of what they could do to improve forecasts than they're actually able to implement.
Mm-hmm.
They're always hungry for more computer power.
And just to go back for a second, what is Doppler radar?
Oh, well, Doppler radar is able to paint a picture, a three-dimensional picture of the weather by reflecting microwaves off of raindrops. And that gives you not only the picture you see on TV, you know, where the rain is, where it's heaviest, but it can also determine wind speeds, which way and how fast the wind is blowing, where the weather is going. And that was really pivotal in proving things like tornado forecasting. Really made a big difference in how soon the forecaster could warn you that a tornado was likely on the way.
Right. So you make an interesting point in your article about how data collection from additional detectors like satellites and these Doppler radar centers have improved. But there's also some changes in how the data that we collect is actually used. And that's had a big impact on our ability to predict. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. These improved observations have to be fed into a forecast model. The model needs to know a starting point for the forecast. What's the weather right now? Mm-hmm. So it can extrapolate, calculate into the future. But getting weather observations into the models is not all that straightforward, especially in the case of weather satellites. Weather satellite data was going into the models starting in the 1970s, but it wasn't being used as effectively as it might have. And so in the 90s, forecasters and model developers figured out better ways to what they call assimilate the observations into the computer models. And so by more effectively using the existing observations, they were able to improve the forecasts, especially forecasts of where hurricanes were going to be going. Hurricanes do not propel themselves. They're carried along and steered by the broad weather patterns that it encounters. And so this improved assimilation of data greatly improves that general pattern prediction, where the highs and the lows and the jet streams are.
Mm-hmm.
That is a key improvement in improving forecasts of where hurricanes are going to go, something that was done very well in the case of Sandy.
Right, right. Of all the major modeling stations out there, the European Center has the best record. Why is that?
Well, the European Center for Medium Range Forecasts has been in operation for more than 30 years, and it has always had the lead in its specialty, forecasting out long range, out toward a week, or now they go much farther even. They have one focus, mm-hmm. and that's long range forecasting around the world. And they have the most computer resources at their disposal for that one kind of forecast. And that combination has kept them in the lead for 30 years. It gave them the edge forecasting Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
The European Center's forecasts were picking up the unusual behavior of Sandy. It was going to take this left turn in toward the eastern seaboard. It picked that up more than a week ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was beating out everybody else's models, U.S. model, British, Japanese. But the models, they came together and reached a consensus 3 or 4 days ahead. which was plenty of time to do what could be done in New Jersey and New York.
When we say that they have the best record, it's not just for predicting this hook in a hurricane's path, but also the number of days ahead, right?
Yes, they are able to produce useful forecasts out to 8.5 days ahead.
Wow. For everyone, for all the centers, there are definitely still some forecasting bugaboos, as you call them, tough to predict phenomena like tornadoes and hurricanes. What makes some of these weather patterns so difficult to predict?
Well, I've mentioned forecasting how strong a hurricane is going to be. That's one. Another is forecasting when a particular storm is going to produce tornadoes. Mm-hmm. The Doppler radar helped increase the lead time for warnings of tornadoes, but it hasn't really improved the situation with, is there going to be a tornado out of that storm or isn't there? Both these phenomena are happening on a small scale, and they're happening very quickly. Tornadoes might come out of a particular storm for 20 minutes out of a several hours lifetime for the storm. A hurricane may intensify a couple categories, you know, from category 2 to category 4 overnight. In both cases, it's all happening inside of a severe thunderstorm or around the eye of a hurricane. That's where you have trouble knowing what's going on from hour to hour. The observations just aren't there. And you have difficulty simulating that in the computer forecast because the computer forecast is very fuzzy. You've got what they call a resolution. How fine a detail can you pick out of 5 or 10 or 20 kilometers?
In short periods of time.
You can't have a Doppler radar by every severe storm in the Midwest.
Right.
We're not there yet by a long shot.
But will we get there? Is the trend of improving predictions that we've seen, is that going to continue?
Well, the improvements in observations continue. The National Weather Service is getting ready to go operational with incorporating airborne radar in hurricane forecasts. Better and better satellites keep going up. And the trend in increasing computer power availability is expected to continue. So forecasters are optimistic about keeping up the improving forecast skills over the next 5 or 10 years. Those two bugaboos, there's some optimism about resolving or solving the hurricane intensity forecast problem, partly with the radar. The tornado problem is going to be tougher to crack.
Okay. Well, Richard Kerr, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Sarah.
Science writer Richard Kerr writes about the advancing science of weather prediction in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm here with science news writer Carolyn Gramling, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. In our first story, we look at a cockatoo prodigy named Figaro. So Carolyn, why is Figaro so special?
Well, Figaro is actually unique among cockatoos, at least as far as we have observed, in that he is the first one to actually both invent and also make tools. Mm-hmm. We know that a lot of different species of birds, most famously, maybe the New Caledonian crows, are sort of natural tool makers. Crows have been known to sort of fashion things out of bamboo, making hooks to sort of forage for grubs and things like that. But we've never actually seen that in cockatoos before.
Okay. So how did the researchers actually discover and begin to study this unique behavior in Figaro?
Well, so normally cockatoos live in the forests of Indonesia, but there's actually a colony of them in Austria, and Figaro lives there in this colony. It's a captive colony. And one day, a student who was studying the birds actually observed Figaro behaving kind of strangely. He observed that he was trying to get a pebble that he had dropped through the wire mesh of his cage, and he was trying to reach for it. He tried with his claw first, and he couldn't get at it. And so then he picked up a piece of bamboo that was lying nearby and was trying to sort of hook it in. And the student thought this was really interesting, and they immediately were curious about how much effort Figaro would put into trying to make a tool to get this pebble.
So what did they do next? They decided to do some experiments. What did they do?
Well, so one thing they wanted to do was, first of all, they'd never seen a cockatoo doing anything like this before, and they didn't want the other birds in the colony to see him doing it and to learn from his behavior. They wanted to know what he would do just on his own and the other birds would not learn from watching. So they isolated Figaro, mm-hmm. and then they placed a peanut just outside his cage on a wooden beam, and they sat back and they watched to see what he would do. And he tried to reach it, and he couldn't reach for it. And so eventually he started experimenting, and he stripped a piece of the wooden beam off and tried to rake the peanut in with that piece of beam. Didn't work. It was too long. He snipped it in half, and then he used it to rake it in again. And so he basically demonstrated all these different aspects of tool making. He mm-hmm. created a tool, he resized it, and he successfully used it to get the peanut.
Okay. And what happened when they looked at other cockatoos? Is this something that they can easily learn?
Well, so the other cockatoos who had initially seen him trying to get the pebble, they learned from that, and they did try to use similar tools like that. But Figaro was the only one that they actually saw innovating.
Okay.
And that's actually a very rare quality among any species.
Okay. And in another event of unexpected findings, our next story looks at a case of mistaken identity for a pair of beached whales in New Zealand.
Yes. So back in 2010, a couple of whales washed up on the shore of New Zealand. It was an adult female and a juvenile male. And they looked a lot like a kind of whale that's known as a gray-beaked whale. And so people just assumed that that's what they were. The officials assumed that's what those whales were. But they did take tissue samples from the whales. And now a genetic analysis of those tissue samples shows that they were never gray-beaked whales in the first place. They were actually a different kind of a whale known as a spade-toothed beaked whale.
So what do researchers actually know about spade-toothed beaked whales? I've never heard of them.
They don't know very much because these whales, there's actually 21 different species of beaked whales, and they are among the least understood of all whales because they spend most of their time at depth. They mate down there, they feed down there, they breed down there. So basically, they hardly ever surface, and we never really see them. So we think of them as very rare. Mm-hmm. So this was actually the first time that anyone has ever actually spotted these spade-toothed beaked whales.
So what did they actually do now that they realized that they had found this extremely rare whale?
Well, I think it's basically because it's the first time anyone has actually seen these whales, they're able to actually, you know, finally get a better understanding of their biology. And so they actually were able to exhume them and try to see basically what their structure is. But we still know so very little about any of these kinds of whales. One thing, though, that's interesting to think about is that even though we think of them as rare, it probably is more likely that we just hardly ever see them because they don't spend much time at the surface.
Mm-hmm. So, Carolyn, what else have we got on the site this week?
Well, Edward, for Science Now, we've got a story about why we think early humans managed to pass along toolmaking and other technological advances to their descendants. And we will also have a story about body storming, which is using the movements of dancers to explain cellular motion. And for Science Insider, our online policy blog, we ask our readers to stay tuned for our ongoing coverage of the aftermath of the U.S. election and what that's going to mean for science. And finally, for Science Live, which is our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is all about cooking food and how that may have been the secret recipe that allowed human brains to grow. And then we have next week's chat, which is going to be about food genomics. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Carolyn Gramling is a news writer for Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the November 9th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.